At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. I am so happy to be speaking with you again this week. I know it's been an interesting time all over the world. So much is happening. And also wanted to let you know that I have been getting some emails about the podcast to my personal email address that are from people who are listening to it in Germany and in Austria and in areas that are still reeling from and healing from World War II. And that's what they are writing to me about, that they're seeing an uptick in the kind of rhetoric and the kind of movements and the kind of othering that happened during sometimes not their lifetime, but their parents' or grandparents' lifetime, but that they remember hearing about, and that it's been quite troublesome. If this is something that you want to write about or have me speak about more, I am happy to. It's something that our podcast cares a lot about. And again, that's not necessarily why it's just about cult groups, but it's about cultic thinking and cultic persuasion and coercion and groupthink and conformity. So please be in touch if this is impacting you as well. For today, we have Penny Lane. She is a survivor, a writer, a wife, and mother with an insatiable passion for life and books. Originally from Jackson Heights, Queens, she is the author of the recently published memoir, Redeemed, a memoir of a stolen childhood, a gritty, ultimately uplifting memoir about a happy-go-lucky girl who was unexpectedly snatched away from her all-American home by her long-lost immigrant father. In her spare time, she volunteers in food pantries and other nonprofits near her home in Mill Valley, California. You can find out more about Penny and her work at www.pennylanewriter.com. We had a wonderful conversation, and I'm so glad you get to hear it. Here is Penny now. I am so delighted to have Penny Lane with me today on the show. It's such a powerful story that when I think about you writing a book and putting this into words, it is such a process. I've had a lot of clients and a lot of people who have been in the process of trying to put their story into words, but first really needing to make sense of it for themselves. The process of writing is usually many processes beforehand just to get to that point of putting pen to paper or finger to keyboard. So I give you a lot of credit for being able to just create a way for us to understand and hear your story as an educational tool, I think as a preventative tool, but also just as a very human story, you know, saying this can happen. And so I would love for you to take a moment to introduce yourself and then we'll start talking.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And I appreciate the invite to your show. My name is Penny Lane. So as you know from my book, I am an adult survivor of child abuse and church abuse that was so dramatic that it was almost worse than my child abuse. And of course, because of my child abuse, I went into it not knowing what it was. When you're abused as a child, you don't develop normally. So you don't have boundaries and safeguards, and red flags don't pop up. What you just think is, well, they're not beating me. They say they love me and they promise me family. It must be okay. And it took 30 years after leaving the abusive situation to be able to write about it. It took that long to be able to heal and process and accept and even live with the shame of it, which we can talk about. It's a lot of shame that comes with being fooled, leaving a church, making such a horrendous decision with your life. It felt shameful and I hid it.
Right. Wow. Interesting. And just by saying that it was worse than the other abuse that you incurred. So I think for people to really understand that, I want you to be able to kind of, even before we get into your story, talk about what you mean by that. Because there are people who have said to me, and maybe they've said to you too, after they've been involved in a cult or after they've been with a very malignant narcissist, that sometimes they wish there had been bruises that they could show people to explain, look what happened, like pointing to a place on the body. And then it's clear. And then people say, oh no. And they'll understand to whatever degree they understand that. But still, there's something tangible to work with. And there's also something about having those bruises heal that is also not something that happens when it's amorphous, when it's not tangible. So from your perspective, what is worse and what was worse about this other kind of abuse?
So when I was a child and being abused by my stepmother, I did have physical abuse, bruises, and I did go to school. For instance, I have a big cut on my forehead, which I talk about in the book. It's a chapter called Bread and Blood. And what happens when you bleed from your forehead is that it goes into your eyes and your eyes become black. You get two black eyes as if somebody punched you. Nobody punched me in the eye, and I went to school like that. I was 7 years old. I went to school with a scab on my forehead, a Band-Aid on my forehead, two black eyes, and obviously distraught, and not a single person on the street, not a single person in school, not a single person in the tenement building that I lived in. Huge apartment building, 10 apartments on a floor, 6 floors. We lived on the 6th floor, meaning I had to go down every single floor either in the elevator or on the stairs. And nobody stopped me and said, are you okay? Not a single person. And so I did have physical bruises and nobody helped me, right? So now fast forward to adulthood, and manipulation and indoctrination is so subtle that it starts with a teeny step. So imagine for a minute, you're a lost runaway. You're 17 years old. You live with your boyfriend who then joins this church. You live with him and you work for him in his restaurant. And somebody says to you at this church, wouldn't you want a forever family? Now, remember, you have nobody. You've ran away from home. You have no family. You have no friends but the people that work in the restaurant and your supposed boyfriend. And somebody says forever family. You say, sure. So it starts with that one little step. And then it goes on to, wouldn't you want to be forgiven for your sins? And you're like, well, I don't really know what sins I've done, but okay, that sounds good. Don't you want to have God's love? Of course, who doesn't want to be loved? I've never been loved before. Let's have some love, right? So it's very subtle. It's very subtle. And then once you're in the church, you start believing the doctrine. Like you start believing in heaven and hell and sin and retribution and the devil and the fire and brimstone. So that by the time you're fully in and the church starts asking unreasonable things of you, you think, if I leave this church, which is what they teach, or I leave my husband, divorce is sin. If I leave my husband, who is so embroiled with the church that he won't leave it for me to protect me or give me another life in another church, if I leave my husband or I leave the church, then I'm going to die and I'm going to live forever in hell, burning with fire and brimstone. You believe that. And so it's harder to leave because you think if you leave, you're consigned to hell and a godless life and misery for the rest of your life. Whereas when I was a child, you know, you're a child, you live day to day. You just want to get through that day. And then as you're older and you become 14 and 15 and 16, you know, I made plans to run away, or I thought, you know, someday I'll have a different life. I had hope in the church. Because of the indoctrination, I had no hope. I thought it was this or nothing. Again, because I'm immature psychologically. The church, by the way, didn't allow me to deal with my childhood trauma. When I brought it up in a meeting with the pastor, a pre-marriage meeting, they told me I was the one in sin for running away from home. They literally made me go back to my stepmother, who physically, mentally, and emotionally abused me, withheld from me, withheld food, withheld gifts that other people gave me, punished me, called me names. I had to go back to her to ask her forgiveness for running away from home. Can you imagine? So the whole thing is so warped. And then when they first heard about my abuse, they said, Penny, no need to talk about it because it was God's will. And because it was God's will, you shouldn't question it. You shouldn't talk about it. And of course, implied in that is no need to get help, i.e. no need to get therapy. And by the way, therapy was not something you even talked about or knew about in the 70s, right? It was God is everything and God is good and God always does what's right for you. So if you were punished, if that was true, what you just told us, meaning that they didn't really believe me, then it was God's will, therefore. So here's a picture of a broken, lost, abused child that met this guy at 16. And then, you know, by the time he joined the church, I was 17 because I met him about 4 months before my 17th birthday. You know, 3 or 4 months after my 17th birthday, he joins this church. And I was in no position to analyze or understand whether this was right or wrong or true or real, or even that there were other options of other churches. I just didn't have the wherewithal. And the only people who even tried to say, you don't have to do this, were the other waitresses at the restaurant that we all worked in. But they were, in my mind, old ladies who didn't know any better. Here was the guy that loved me and provided for me. And these were old ladies that were working in a restaurant, right? In my eyes, in my 17-year-old eyes. What did they know about love? Or, you know, I was indoctrinated. And, you know, for years, I blamed myself for being stupid enough to do that. And it wasn't until I really started writing the book that I realized, how would I have known better? Because now, fast forward 30 years after I've left the church, I have a then 16-year-old, now a 19-year, almost 20-year-old son. And I realize how naive and undeveloped and immature he is. Wouldn't be able to, even though he's had a very good and very stable and very loving upbringing by two parents who are actualized and mature and stable and loving, he wouldn't be able to navigate that. So how would I, who got none of what he got, none of the love and security and wisdom and training?
It's incredible. So just want to say, going back for a moment when you were talking about needing to go back and ask for forgiveness from your abuser, just the way you're taught right then to look at things, like you're saying, in a very opposite way. And there is this reversal of victim and perpetrator that is mind-bending. And then do you have the right then to be upset about what happened? Because after all, you're the one at fault. So you can start to get the message soon after that you don't matter and your pain didn't matter. And that they're certainly not going to care about it. No one really needs to care about it because you're the one who did something wrong. There's like this overlay that is put on top of someone's experience that we have to see it through that lens. It's like these women who I work with who have been abused by their Buddhist teachers. And in almost every case, they were told by different teachers, well, this is to heal your karma. You must have done something. This is their abuser saying this sometimes, must have done something in a past life that drew me to you in this way, that I did this for you to heal your karma. You're welcome. And so what? And so where do you go with what happened to you and who's going to care about that? It reminding me also, wow, someone I heard about recently who is a teenager who has severe depression and was feeling suicidal and went to a day treatment place that used a 12-step model. And he was my client at the time too. And he said, I need to make amends. And I wrote a letter to make amends. I said, make amends for what? Well, they said that's one of the steps. And so I had to make amends. And so I apologized to you for such and such. He already had a guilty conscience. That's what was leading him to feeling depressed. And I called the place and I said, how dare you? How dare you make this person have to write apology letters and amends? He wanted to kill himself, but you're putting him through this program that is this overlay. Like it doesn't fit what he needs, and it's making him feel worse, and it's making him feel responsible. And you just can't do that to people. The other thing I want to mention, just in case people don't know, is that all too recently, because it should have existed a long time ago, there's a designation of being a mandated reporter. So teachers, clergy to a certain degree, even though there's confidentiality there, clergy confidentiality, which is sometimes problematic, therapists, others, librarians, I mean, anyone who's going to come across kids who feel like something is off, they look different, they are supposed to, by law now, respond. And that was not the case. And so kids like you fell through the cracks.
That's right. That's right. As a matter of fact, when I was a kid, and I was precocious, I was meaning that I thought a lot and I asked questions, not at home. I wasn't allowed to, but I imagined though that day that I walked to school with the bruises, with the black eyes, that somebody would see me and call the police and the police would march home with me to my stepmother and put her in jail. Like, you know, that's what you think as a 7-year-old, right? And when it didn't happen, huge awareness came over me that I was really all, even my father, when he came home from work, didn't notice for a few days what was wrong with me. And then she had coached me to lie to him. And of course I did, because I spent my days at home alone with her and he was away at work and came home late at night and was already drunk, maybe when he came home. And so I was afraid and I did what she said until he forced me otherwise. And it was very scary. It was very scary. And I realized at 7, I'm all alone. Nobody's going to rescue me.
Mm-hmm.
Sad. It's very sad.
Very, very sad. Yes, it happens a lot. People who have talked to me who have been in compounds that were raided, and the leaders were able to charm, you know, the police and others into thinking everything was just fine here. And it was someone just trying to get back at the group in some way by making the report. And there are people who are now adults who said as kids, when they saw the law enforcement or whoever had shown up just leaving and leaving them there, they thought, oh, well, now I know there is no one. And so, yeah, there are these devastating watershed moments in terms of sort of hopefulness into hopelessness that I think people don't realize are just these pivotal moments that they need to step up in those moments to keep someone feeling hopeful.
What I didn't realize as a child, and I didn't realize as a young adult, again, writing is so, I didn't write the book to be therapeutic. I thought, you know, I'm pretty much healed, quote unquote. But when I wrote the book, and the feedback I've gotten since has been huge growth for me. And one of the things I didn't realize was that at home as a child, my stepmother set me up in the dysfunctional family triad, whereas I was the scapegoat. Everything was my fault, even though I did the housework and the cleaning and the errands, and I took care of my baby sister. I was still the bad guy. Everything was my fault. I was terrible. I was evil. I was bad. And then I grow up and I get to this church and I'm the same thing all over again. It's all my fault. Nobody else did anything wrong. I'm again bad and evil and wrong. And I'm already programmed from my childhood to think of myself as less than and broken and damaged and bad and abnormal and other, although we didn't have the word other in the 70s and 80s when I was in the church. Now I'd say they made me an other. The church made me an other so that I didn't fit and didn't belong. And I realized it took decades and decades of learning and growing and healing and therapy before just recently, in the last 5 years, a therapist said to me, Penny, it was never your fault. It was never you. It was always them. And I can't tell you how healing and what a weight is lifted off when you finally get to that point. But it's so hard. We're so indoctrinated, subconsciously indoctrinated, that it's so hard to believe that, that it's never our, it was never our fault. All I ever wanted to be was normal and happy. I never wanted any more than that. I didn't want, yeah, of course I wanted to be loved, but it's shocking.
It is really shocking. And I want to hear more of your story. I just wanted to say this other thing as you're reminding me. So a number of years ago, I wrote this book. It's an illustrated book for children going through divorce. It's called Now I Know, Kids Talking to Kids About Divorce. And I took the information from kids who were going through a divorce, and then a year after, interviewing them, what they needed during that time, what was helpful during that time. And one of the things, and sort of a kind of a guide for parents and caregivers also, like, this is what your kids are really needing, or this is what they really appreciated that you did. Over and over again, the kids said, I needed to hear, or I was glad I heard, because sometimes they didn't hear it, but sometimes they did hear it, that the divorce was not my fault. Because actually, sometimes they heard that it was. You know, I never wanted to have children and, you know, et cetera, right? And so, you know, kids are kind of often, because you're naturally self-focused as a child, you wonder, is it my fault? What did I do? It's just a natural proclivity to do that. And so you have to kind of help a child feel like they're not on the witness stand, like that it's not them. And you have to, you might assume that they know it, but it's important to say it out loud.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I was so precocious that I said to myself, if I'm just good enough, let me try really hard and then I won't get in trouble. And then she won't hate me. She won't call me mean names. And so what that created in me was this overachiever and over people pleaser. Work so hard, like she'd leave the house and leave me and say, sweep the kitchen, sweep the, and she'd come home. And the first thing she'd do is said, there's some dirt under the table, smack, right? Like it, I could never, what I didn't realize, you know, you don't realize this as a kid, is you'll never be good enough because they're the ones that have the problem, not you. And no 7 or 6 or 5 or 8, 10-year-old, 12-year-old, 15-year-old should have to measure up to an impossible standard. It's an impossible standard.
Right. It is impossible. Right. And you will be guilty till never proven innocent because that's their MO in the world. Like that they
is that you're guilty.
Right. Exactly. And they can then be the victim of you somehow, like, you know, that you've made them angry. Yes. There's so many good life lessons here. I just wish we were making a list. Like, please follow the following things. Okay, so going back to your story. So here you are in this church, and what happens while you're there? Tell us more about your experiences.
So we lived in Manhattan when we first started going to church, and that church was what we call legalistic, meaning there are rules. Women don't wear pants, women don't wear high heels, women don't wear lots of makeup, you don't listen to rock music, you don't, you know, drink, you don't smoke, you know, all that stuff. Some of that you can live with. I didn't like it, but you know, it's a gradual thing. And I kind of felt like I was given the bait and switch, meaning come to Jesus, come to Jesus, come to Jesus. And then, oh, once you come to Jesus, then they surround you and say, no, you can't dress that way anymore. Well, you never told me that. I've been dressing like that for 2 months. Now you tell me, right? You don't tell me ahead of time what the cost of this. You tell me after. Okay. So then we moved to Maryland, and there we kind of met this charismatic. None of the churches were good enough for my husband in Maryland. By this point, we're married. And we joined a Bible study in somebody's home, this charismatic guy that was in seminary. And when he graduated seminary, he couldn't even become ordained in this Baptist convention that he was going to school in because his views were like very left or very, you know, very off center. And that should have been a warning flag. But what we thought, or what my husband thought, was everybody else is wrong and he's the right one, right? So he eventually gets ordained in some obscure little denomination and then gets assigned to a church in rural Michigan, an old congregation that's like 150 years old. run by four or five old ladies at the some society, Women's Historical Society of this town of 200 runs this little church, middle of nowhere, literally. And we go to visit because, of course, they move away. My husband misses him, misses this pastor, and misses the righteous teaching. And we go to visit, and I hated every minute of it. I'm a city girl from New York City, right? And this is a town of 200. And there is literally nothing there. And even the next town is hardly anything there. The next town is a town of 2,000. And 10 miles away from that is a town of 10,000. And even that is so remote from city life. Anyway, I just endure the whole 5-day visit. We drive back from Michigan to Maryland. I'm like, okay, great. I'm going to get on with my life. We're going to go to a regular church. I'm going to be a good Christian wife. And then we receive a phone call and the pastor's wife has found us an apartment in Michigan. Now, he must have told her that was okay. Nobody ever checked with me or asked me or told me. And so, you know, I could have lived a normal, what I call a normal Christian life. You go to church on Sunday, maybe you go to Bible study on Wednesday night. But the church in Michigan wanted everything, wanted to control your whole life, who you associated with, who you didn't. They defined community as you ask us before you make any major decision. Should I have another babe? Should I buy a house? Should I live here? Should I live there? And they also believed in gifts. And what gifts meant was that some people had the gift of vision or dreams. And these people had carte blanche, right? I mean, how do you validate a vision? God told me that somebody's in sin in the church. We think it's you, Penny, because why? I don't know. And you can't speak to your accuser. You can't defend yourself. You're alone at home and you're told not to associate with the church because you're working with the devil and you could harm people in the church. So of course you're petrified of this and you're trembling and you're scared. And they look at the trembling and the fear as you must have done something wrong. Why would you be trembling if you didn't do anything wrong? Well, you just accused me of working with the devil that we believe in as a congregation. We believe that these are real entities and real truth. And your husband is against you because, of course, your husband chooses the church and chooses God and righteousness over you. And so it's a really hard place to be because you left your whole life in Maryland. You've moved to this rural town in Michigan and your only friends, the only people you associate with are people in the church. There's no need to associate with anybody else, right? Unless you're bringing them into the church. And they're of the devil. And they're worldly. And of course, that includes no news, no newspapers. Why? God controls the world. You don't need that. God controls the government. So here you are isolated, both emotionally, physically, psychologically, intellectually. You have no news of the world. You have nobody to check with. Is this okay? As a matter of fact, at one point I was working in a little coffee shop, ice cream place, and the woman who ran it, her name was Beth, was a normal, what I call a normal Christian, went to a Baptist church on Sundays, etc. And he saw me crying at work. And when I finally told her what was going on, and I told nobody, I was so ashamed that I was excommunicated and that I was alone in my apartment, couldn't talk to anybody, and etc. She said, Penny, you need to talk to some other pastors about this. This is not right. I immediately ran away and said, no, I can't. Because if I talk to another pastor, they'll never talk to me again in this church because everybody else is wrong and they're right. And I couldn't see. I couldn't see. I was so indoctrinated. I was so brainwashed into what they believed and what needing to be married to my husband and needing. That was all I had. I was still estranged from my family. I had no resources because, of course, the husband is the head of the wife and he controls the funds. Had no money. Even the money I made, I put into our joint bank account because that was the rule. So it was a horribly untenable situation. Luckily, I couldn't get pregnant, right? I had a fertility problem. And so that's why we didn't have kids. I think that would have made it much harder to leave. I think for your other listeners that do have kids, I can't imagine that pain because there was another woman who left the church before me and she had to leave her kids behind. And she went back to rural West Virginia where she was from, but her family were what I call normal everyday Christians. and they got a lawyer and they fought. And finally, she got her kid back. And as it turns out, I later found out a couple of years ago, so decades after I left the church, that that woman's husband eventually left the church. My ex-husband eventually left the church, all excommunicated for vague and intangible reasons of not following some vague doctrine or lying or accusation of something that nobody could prove or nobody could defend or nobody could stop doing. And so it's a horrific, horrific, horrific thing. Like leaving my children, I probably would have killed myself first. I don't know. Because now that I am a mother, I feel that way that you would have to pry my child out of my dead arms. Like I can't imagine leaving a child or two. She did. This other woman did leave her two children and came back for them and got them, fought for them and got them. So I was lucky in the sense that I eventually adopted. If you're wondering how I had a child, we eventually adopted.
Yeah, which is lovely. I'm happy for you. You know, there are a lot of people in situations where they have to leave their children and hope to be able to get them at some point. Sometimes people feel so beaten down that they're not sure they can care for their children. And then other people will leave with their kids. And I've had situations here where people have shown up, they packed up the car, and suddenly I have a whole family in my waiting room with kids who are like, I don't know where we are exactly, but I know we're not home. And everywhere in between, so many stories. But I think that it really is incredible to hear, I mean, that you, your lack of fertility in some ways made things easier. And, you know, I guess there are different ways to look at things in retrospect and wonder how your life would have been different. But I'm so glad you were able to enjoy having a child while you were free. So take us to the next part of the story. I'm really curious about how you move from where you just left off to the next part of your life.
When I left, which was in September of 1991, and I was almost 32 years old, I had reunited with my half-brother, who was 5 years younger than me, and living in San Francisco. And I knew nobody else in the world, right, that I could rely on. And so I called him when I separated, when I knew I was leaving the church. I didn't leave right away because I had nowhere to go and I had no money. So I moved with a cousin who happened to live in Michigan that I wasn't close to. He was part of the stepmother's family, but he took me under her wing, her and her husband. I lived with them and worked for a couple months to get money together for a flight. And I called my brother and I said, hey, I'm leaving. And I was so ashamed because he was a Harvard educated guy. He didn't believe in the church and God. He thought it was all like poppycock from the beginning. And I felt terribly humiliated and ashamed that I fell for it. And now I was admitting that I was leaving the church and leaving my husband and that I was wrong. But to his credit, he never, ever, ever got down on me. He never said, I told you so. Never. He just said, absolutely, you can come live with me. There's some conditions. You know, he knew I didn't smoke pot and he did. And he knew I didn't drink and he did. He laid down the rules. He said, you're not my mom. This is my life. I'm like, okay, anything. And so we made plans for me to move out to San Francisco where he was going to law school. And I shared an apartment with him. And I flew out, and you know, San Francisco is really in the early 90s. It's really different than rural, conservative, Christian, white Michigan, and I was in for a huge culture shock. So I got a job right away. I was very scared. I had $1,200 to my name, which is what I was able to save over 3 or 4 months. My first month rent was $600. So, and the only thing I had ever done, I didn't have a college degree. The only thing I'd ever done was waitress. And so I got a waitress job. I got two right away. Like on my third day there, I found a waitress job, but it's only part-time here and part-time there. And I, you know, was broken. I was a broken person. I literally cried all the time. He was in law school during the day, so I was home alone. My waitressing jobs were at night. I was home alone in the day and it was raining and cold and gray in San Francisco. And there was weirdos out there that pierced eyebrows and green hair and, you know, things that I wasn't used to, right? Because I'd been in an isolated community for a long time. So I got a job and my brother said, listen, I can't listen to you cry all the time. I'm a student and I'm working as a clerk for this guy. Here's a number for Marina a counseling center. You need to go get therapy. And I did. And it was very hard for me. I didn't even know what therapy was. I'd never heard of it before. And it was expensive. And I'm a waitress and I have no money, right? Luckily, they were sliding scale. And I started going to therapy. And I started hanging out with what I'm going to call normal people. These are people 5 to 10 years younger than me, my brother's age. So like mid-20s, just recently graduated high school or graduated and now going into law school or grad school. And they all had degrees and they all talked confidently and they talked about where they traveled and work and jobs. And it was a world I had never been in, right? I went from a waitress at the IHOP at 16 into a church and just came out at the other end. I literally was absent from the world for 15 years, right? So I didn't really understand what college was, but they all talked about college. And so I decided I need to go to college. So I enrolled in City College and waitressed, ended up getting a day job and went to school at night. And you know what? Unbeknownst to me, because my stepmother always told me I was stupid and worthless and would never amount to anything, I started getting A's and B's in school at college at night, right? And I thought I was stupid, but one of my new friends that I made said, "Hey, Penny, they're hiring at this finance job where she works. I think you should apply." And I said, "Oh no, they won't hire me. I'm too stupid and I don't have a degree yet." And she said, "Penny, you're plenty smart. I think you should apply and they'll train you." So I did apply. And guess what? They hired me. And when I went to work, I saw a stack of resumes, because this was 92, right? Stacks of paper resumes on my boss's desk. And I knew they hired me over those people in that stack. And I was still going to school at night. And it was amazing. It was so all of these little tiny things started boosting my self-esteem. And I started dating again. Now, before I could date, I got to tell you the story. In my lonely, lonely, lonely hours, I had to come to grips with the fact that I no longer believed in God and was sorry that I ever did. And so that means with that went all the precepts that were built into my head about drinking or smoking or marijuana or dating or premarital sex or wearing makeup or wearing earrings, which were a sin in the church to wear pearls, gold, or decorative accoutrement, right? Because we're supposed to be modest and reflect our husband and reflect Christ, right? So each time, I had to deconstruct everything I believe and reconstruct it one step at a time, as if I was 16, but in the body of a 32-year-old. So do I get acrylic nails? I guess I do. Do I go on a date? I guess I do. Do I have sex? I guess maybe I do, right? All of these things I had to reconstruct. Do I go dancing, which I loved, which was forbidden in the church? I did. Now, this is very gradual and over, you know, many years. It didn't all happen right away. But I was like a kid at 32 and I had to rebuild my life. And I eventually did start dating again and I kissed a lot of frogs. In the meantime, I'm going to therapy. So, right, I'm going to therapy. I'm working full time. I'm dating and I'm going to school, right? So each thing is bouncing off the other and I can question, is this right? Is this right? Of course, I had a long and protective list. I vowed to never depend on a guy again. And so I had to go into a field that meant a woman on her own could afford a house. Nobody's going to take my home away again. No, I'm not going to depend on a guy again. I wanted to be a mother someday. All right. I was still in my 30s. It was still possible. So I went into finance. I got a degree. I got my financial licenses, which are very hard. They're like bar exam. The 50% failure rate. You know, I started getting all those things. And building my wall of security, saving every dime, working two jobs to have money to save, right? And really compressing what should have been a normal childhood into 10 years of, do you do this? Do you do that? Do you drink? Do you smoke? Do you eat? Do you that? Do you exercise? You know, everything that you would have learned from 10 to 23, I had to learn in my 30s. And so that's what happened. And so what my abuse and neglect and trauma from childhood created was this overachiever, because A, I was catching up. B, I was building a wall of security around me that nobody could take away If you don't depend on anybody else, nobody can take away your security, right? So even though on the outside, to you or to somebody else, I looked healthy and ambitious and successful, on the inside, what was driving me was fear and never wanting to be alone again or a loss of home or have my home taken away or so unbelievable protectiveness and drive to be and also to be the best. So when I was at work, I had to be the best employee because I didn't want you to fire me. And at school, I had to get A's and B's because I didn't want my stepmom to be right that I was stupid. And as a girlfriend, I had to be the best because I didn't want you to stop loving me because I forgot didn't do something. As a mom, I had to be the best because A, I didn't want to repeat my childhood, but B, I wanted to be a good mother like I didn't have. So the upside is I became this upstanding, very successful person. The downside is that it's motivated by fear and it's overcompensation and you hide the bad parts of yourself because you think everybody else is normal and they're not. And so it took many years before I started sharing my story with the general population, with my friends.
Okay. So a couple thoughts about the things that you're saying. One, you know, when you were talking about developing a sense of yourself and developing a certain level of confidence, or maybe just feeling like, oh, maybe I am not stupid, you know, seeing all of the other resumes on the desk, seeing that you were compared to lots of other people and they chose you, I'm sure it blew your mind, just blew your mind. You know, like, well, I didn't know that was possible and maybe it's a mistake. And, you know, I mean, I think a lot of people just really wonder about those moments and having your friends say, no, I think you're plenty smart. I mean, you know, what? How can it be that I've never been told this? I think about all the people who are unfortunately kind of languishing in the state that they were raised in, the emotional state, the location, the church that needs for them to feel less than so that they can not have the desire, I think, to leave at any point. And how much and sometimes how little it takes to have someone feel capable. I mean, I'm even thinking about it for not just every sentient being. I'm thinking, believe it or not, my son adopts does elder adoption for dogs, and which is such a lovely thing, a mitzvah. So the dog that he has now, who is older, was old when he adopted her. He named her Chicken because that's what she looked like when found her. Like she barely had any, you know, she looked like a tired old chicken. No, almost no fur. And you know, something was clearly wrong. And it turns out that she has different health issues and dietary issues and everything was making her hair fall out and not be able to gain weight. So it meant finding the right diet for her, putting her on medication for she actually has a disease, like putting her on medication so she could tolerate food and take it in. And then her hair started to grow. And now she looks like a cute little puppy dog, even though she's older. And I think, you know, when you see the graduation of the photos from the beginning to the end, that's what love does. That's what attending to someone, saying, what do you need? How can I help you? And sometimes it doesn't take so much. Because especially if it's something you've never received. But I don't know how much you don't believe it at first.
Right. I think you don't believe it at first. And what I say now when I talk about my book, and I talk in book talks, is my friends, the new friends I created after I left, were my mirror. In other words, my friend Helen, who got me the job in finance, was a mirror that said, look, you're not really stupid. And one of the first guys I started dating, and he said, when did you realize you were a pretty girl? I said to myself, just now. Because I didn't know. I didn't get that, right? And then when I started being a superstar at work, for example, here's a girl who didn't finish college till, by the way, I graduated high school at 16. So I was smart, But I didn't connect that with smart, that I was able to graduate early. And A's and B, you know, B's and C's. I wasn't a rock star student, but I still got it done. After I got my college degree, I got hired by Merrill Lynch, which back in the 90s was a big, big giant name in finance. And, you know, not everybody gets a job at Merrill Lynch. And then it started clicking for me like, oh, now I was a clerk at Merrill Lynch. I was at the bottom of the food chain, just up from the janitor, but it didn't matter. What mattered to me was I had a global name on my resume and I worked for them and highly respected and, you know, somewhat paid. It wasn't well, but it was a start. And my next job was better and better and better. So that my last job was like a pearl of a company that like is so hard to get into that people don't even try. And like it takes, you start somewhere and after a decade or so, you start believing. I'm not saying it took a decade, you know, it really takes a long time to change your mindset and the neurons that say you're dumb or you're not worthy. And I'll give you one more example that maybe your friends, your listeners can relate to. I met my husband when I was 37. No, sorry. Yeah. I met him at 36. When I turned 40, so we had been dating 4 years, he surprised me and took me on a hot air balloon in Napa, California, where we live. God said, you need to be up at 3 a.m. You drive through the dark, you get there in before the light. And he said, you got to take the day off. You got to dress this way. And I thought, oh, what's going on? We got there and I saw what it was. And he invited my best friends to be in the hot air balloon with us because he knew I would enjoy not just being two of us, but like a whole group. And when I saw this, I started crying and I said, I don't deserve this. And he said, yes, you do. And this is 9 years after I had left and 4 years after I met this guy, this normal guy, loving guy. So that's how deep it is that I burst into tears and said, I don't deserve it. It took someone else to show me that I did. I couldn't see it after 9 years of therapy or 8 years of therapy and many successes.
You know, it's why I think getting your story out is so important, because I think as people learn from your story, hopefully if they're in a position where they are going to be raising children, or they are raising children, to hear the story about how much you're indoctrinated at a young age in a way that becomes embedded. And so it's like written in Sharpie. And so what do you do with that? You try to heal it if you can, but it still takes a lot to kind of chip away at it. And does it ever go away? You know, you wonder about that. I guess I have a question about that too. When you were saying that you needed to make sure that you were the best or that you were going to be above, you know, everyone else, if you wanted to keep that job or that husband or whatever else, what happens? I kind of want to introduce the idea of misstepping, of just being human. And what happens if you got something in late or, you know, those moments, how did you handle those moments of lack of perfection?
Yeah. So I never got anything late into school because I was that annoying student that like, if you gave me an assignment that was due in 3 weeks, I started on it the next day and I tried to hand it in to you a week early so that you could tell me if it was okay, quote unquote, right? But at work, I was in sales, right? And sales is a brutal taskmaster. I'm sure some of your listeners know that. There's always a quota over your head. And of course, they make the quota high on purpose. They make it hard to attain because they hire overachievers. They're very good at spotting overachievers. And they make it hard to attain so that you'll work really hard to attain it, right? And then they winnow out the people that don't attain. And that's their business model, right? So in my sales career, if I thought I wasn't going to make my quota, I would literally wake up every night in the middle of the night with a cold sweat and fear, like, oh, shoot, I don't know how I'm going to make my quota. And so there was a couple of times I didn't make my quota. And, I didn't get fired because, you know, things tend to go in trends. And that means other people didn't make their quotas either, like, you know, market crashes and stuff like that. So I was fine, but it created unbelievable anxiety inside of me and loss of sleep and loss of appetite, losing weight. I mean, you know, you can tell I'm not, When I lose weight, it's like I didn't need to necessarily lose weight, but I wasn't sleeping and wasn't eating because I was so anxious about whether or not I would make that deadline or quota. I tend to apologize a lot. I'm the first one to say I'm sorry, which is, you know, a habit I need to break because I shouldn't be sorry if I'm not wrong. So yeah, it does create problems. I eventually left sales. I eventually quit because it was just more and more stressful. And that's something I, for example, never got over. I never was able to get to the point to say, you'll be okay. And if you get fired, you'll find another. I was never, like, it was too stressful for me.
Yeah, right. Very interesting. Right. So holding yourself up to a certain standard, still that impossible standard.
Yes, unfortunately.
Right. And then how do you, I mean, you know, there was an idea that got introduced to the therapeutic lexicon a couple decades ago. Also, I think late in the game, but still better late than never. This idea of the good enough parent, the good enough person. And that's a hard one because where is that line? And what risk are you going to be causing yourself if you set that and you say, oh, I did a good enough job because it's amorphous. And so what does that look like? I think about that even with artists. How do they know they're done? How do you know you're done with a painting and a sculpture? And like, because, you know, it depends. If you're perfectionistic, you might not ever feel like you did a good enough job. If you can step back and say, actually, I like this, then it's good enough, whatever that means, or maybe even just good. But I wonder if it's hard to set that gauge. Like if it's time to go to bed and you can't work on something anymore and, you know, you really just need to get back to sleep. I'm sure that's a hard one.
It is really hard. I'm glad you brought that up because I, again, using my community as my mirror, I have a very, very good friend of about 16 years who happens to be a psychiatric social worker and also a therapist herself. Great upbringing, very stable person. She has a lot of hard things in her life. Continually ill husband, autistic son that's going to live with them forever. She started in the last couple of years when you ask her, how you doing? And say, good enough. Meaning, it's not perfect. I can't fix everything. But for where we are, this is good enough. And I've learned from that, that that's a really good answer. Because it's never going to be perfect. It's not perfect now for me. But what's wrong are things I can't change. So I just live, you know, this is it. This is, sometimes things happen. Sometimes it doesn't go the way you want. Sometimes, you know, and so I'm learning to live with that. I'm learning to live with less than perfect. It's not easy, but I'm learning.
Right. Oh, it's not. Oh, yeah. It's definitely not easy. And, you know, I think also when you were the cause of everything, then, I mean, just think of the weight, the burden of that, walking around being the cause of everything. That's bad. That's happening. Then you must feel like you can't take a risk because a tiny misstep will be the aha. See? And I'm sure that gets tangled up in this too.
Yeah. You know, as a parent and a parent of a teenager, teenagers don't always follow a linear path and you don't always get to choose the outcome. And so that's been a big lesson for me is not my fault. You know, we did the best we could. I did the best. I was the best mother I knew how to be. And the rest I have to leave up to fate and their choices, whatever they decide to make and whatever they decide to do. It is hard, but it's a mantra that I have to keep repeating. I mean, one of the things that has helped me is about 10 years ago, I think maybe 11 now, I started practicing, learning about and practicing insight meditation as a way to calm the anxiety inside of me. It comes with a whole teaching about equanimity and knowing that everything changes, that nothing's permanent. And that has helped a lot, but it's definitely something you have to keep practicing and reminding yourself of. It doesn't become second nature to me, at least.
Right. Yeah. I think it is really interesting. I think also just about being a mother, when you're raised in a certain way, it does inform the decisions that you make as a parent. And I'm wondering if you feel comfortable going into that a little bit without divulging you know, any private information or private details, but just your parental philosophy, you know, as it was shaped by your own experiences.
When I was young, I wanted more than anything to be loved. I wanted to be loved. So I made sure that we loved our kid as much as we can, hugged him and kissed him all the time, and started telling him at a very, very, very young age that he was loved. And we started saying to each other across the room, "I love you." And he'd say back, "I love you. Love you, Mom." We still do that to this day. And it's wonderful because sometimes that's all you get from a 19-year-old. You don't get a lot of conversation or other stuff. And the other things I made sure that he got were things that I didn't get: security, safety, lots of food, resources, that he was warm, that he had toys, that he had books. Things that were withheld from me, I made sure he got, not in overabundance, not spoiled. And I believe we gave that to him. We made childhood fun. He didn't have a lot of responsibilities, and be that good or bad. And so it wasn't big things. It was the normal stuff: love, security, warmth, food, stability. And he had all of that. And so I think I broke that cycle and gave him what I didn't get.
Right. It's a lovely thing when people do break the cycle, that you hear about that not happening, I think, sometimes, often enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I think people try to be reasonable as they get older, saying, well, my parent had a really rough upbringing, and so that's why they do this. My feeling is that it can be a reason for an abusive parent being abusive, but it's not an excuse.
Right, right. I was really careful to not repeat any of the patterns. And when he was young, I will admit, and I'm very ashamed of this, that I yelled at him a lot. And I remember reading in one of the newspapers that yelling is the new spanking, right? Like, and I yelled because I didn't understand normal childhood. Like, I didn't understand a child that you said, you know, do this or don't do this, and they did the opposite. They didn't do it. Like, I didn't understand. Like, what aren't you getting? Because I had no picture of normal childhood, right? And so once I vowed to stop that, and I was very ashamed. I went, you know, kept going to therapy and learned how to, you know, deal with it somewhat. But I think my childhood definitely affected my parenting, not in the way one would think, I wasn't abusive, I wasn't neglectful, or I didn't deprive or any of that. It was more like unreasonable standards, because I didn't understand what normal childhood looked like. Unreasonable standards, unreasonable demands, expectations of certain things, very cut and dry, very black and white. I applied my own standards to, you know, a child, which is impossible, right? And wrong. We're yet to see whether damage was done, but, you know, I did the best I could. But I think overridingly, our son knows that we love him and that I love him. I think that matters a lot. And he's generally an empathetic and kind person. So I think the outcome looks good, right? I mean, someday he'll tell me you were this and you were that, and I'll apologize. But I did the very best I could with what I had.
Right. Right. I think one of the things that kids really benefit from is having a parent who takes in what they're doing and sees the impact and is open to learning and is open to the feedback of, you know, maybe you don't need to do this and treat a child this way. And also being able to see a parent who's open to learning about child development, like what is expected at certain ages and what is part of quote unquote normal development at different stages. Like saying no or spilling or, you know, all the things that you couldn't do. You just couldn't be a child.
Yeah. Well, luckily I co-parent with a guy that had a relatively normal childhood. And so not without problems. And so I had a partner to share things with, and we both got help when we needed it through parental coaches and parental therapy that, like, no, what's the right thing to do? Because sometimes you don't know. And we did get some help. But I think overall, our kid is very stable and very solid. And so I think I dodged a bullet there.
Yes. I wanted to come back to something that I saw in some of your writing. I think I saw it on your site. The idea of feeling like an imposter. Because imposter syndrome is something a lot of people talk about. And just not knowing if you're supposed to be where you are and if, you know, because you learn to have this false front to survive. And I feel like there are many more people who feel like imposters than let on about it, feel like they're the outlier. If they go to a party, everyone else seems to know how to do whatever, and they, right? And if you were to ask people, do you feel totally comfortable here? Most people would say, absolutely not, but they know how to fake it. You know, I know there could be other things that you want to broach before we finish up, but I wanted to make sure to come back to this because I saw that word imposter in your writing.
Yeah. So I've always felt like I'm different from other people, meaning that I meet you and I say, oh, Rachel's probably had a normal childhood. Look, she looks happy and normal and together. So I'm going to assume you've had a normal childhood. Eight times out of 10, you haven't had. You've had some trauma. A grandmother died, a cat died, you got bullied at school. If you were protected from the worst childhood experiences, then even that little bit of trauma may have traumatized you. So wherever I go, I'm always aware that, oh, that person must have went to Ivy League. That person went to, I hope they don't know that I went to night school and graduated from a night school, right? So I always felt other because until, you know, maybe 10, 15 years into my career, when I realized, you know what? I'm in the top 1 or 2 or 3 or 4% of the sales staff. So even though they went to that Ivy League and they had a normal childhood and she's a sorority girl and he's a frat boy and he played football in college and she was, you know, prom queen, I'm doing okay. And that took a long time. And that's where the imposter syndrome feels like comes in, where you feel like, am I really doing this? Do I really know how to sell? What if my boss comes with me on a sales call and realizes I don't really know how to sell? And, you know, and of course, bosses do come with you on sales calls and they're fine with you because you're producing. That's all they care, right? But anyway, I did struggle with that a lot and I kind of still do. And I'll give you an example. You knew I was a waitress. Waitresses make, you know, under, you might make 20, 24,000. This was in the 90s. And I rose and I went to college, as you heard. I got financial licenses. I went to graduate school. I kept building my career and moved up the ranks from one great company to the next great company to a greater company to a greater company than that and making, you know, right? And so I am now in a different economic group, right? I'm in an affluent town. I belong to a white collar affluent society. But I don't feel that way. I feel like the blue collar waitress and I live that way, right? I don't, you know, I drive a modest car. I wear modest clothes. I shop at the Gap and Old Navy. Can I afford Nordstrom's? Of course. Could I afford better than Nordstrom's? Of course. But do I? No, I don't identify with that. I identify with where I came from. I don't really know why. Is it fear? Is it never feeling, always feeling other, always feeling like the imposter? I don't know. But I have to be reminded constantly of where I am.
Right. Embroiled in this is also, I think, some humility because, you know, people who don't ever have imposter syndrome, I think I worry about them too. Like the, yeah, I'm great here and I know what I'm doing, even though I don't. You know, I think that hubris is problematic as well. I think about that when I was newly licensed, or even when I was teaching special ed, just my first classrooms or my first clients as a therapist, and they'd come in to see me, and I think, why? Why? Well, I don't think I can help you because I don't know what I'm doing. And so it wasn't until I felt like I had done enough research where I felt like, and maybe that's me needing to know that I have to, and they say this is also often more true for women than men, that you have to be really, 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 really good at what you're doing and really schooled in order to say, I think I know how to do this. And so I think it's an interesting thing with imposter syndrome to also be assuming things about other people's lives and that it's better than yours. And sometimes that's the case, but sometimes certainly not. I think about how many people I've talked to who were involved in a cult or situation where they thought they were the only ones who were suffering and having a bad time. And that's never the case. It's usually a majority who are suffering. They might not have the words for it to understand why, but they know something is off. They feel miserable, but they have a smile on their face anyway. And people are kind of faking it till they make it in a lot of these.
Very, very true. And I think isolation is part of the reason why people feel like they're the only one. Like, I was kept isolated as a child. I think early on in my young, you know, as a young child, I must have told my step aunt or step grandmother something. And they told my stepmother. And when I got home, I got a beating for talking about telling people. And I was accused of lying. Why did you lie? Right. So in other words, you took away my truth. You made my truth a lie to protect yourself. And the same thing in the church. I was isolated. And when the trouble came in the church, they said, you can't talk to anybody. You can't fellowship with anybody. So don't talk to anybody about it. You keep it here and the pastors will come back to you. And so that isolation makes you think you're the only one. Because if you could talk to people about it, now you can see there's lots of memoirs about abused children. Lots of memoirs about church abuse, books written about women who are oppressed in the church that leave the church because they couldn't have a person. They couldn't be a person. But we didn't know that when we're in it, right? And so that isolation and that silencing by our abusers leads us to think that we're the only one. And for me, a big turning point was when I read Dorothy Allison's book called The Bastard Out of Carolina. It came out in 92. I don't think I read it till 93 or 94 or 95, but she was an abused child in a very poor rural town in the South. It's fiction, but it was based on her life story. And it was the first time I realized, oh, there's other abused children out there. I had no idea. Why? I didn't tell anybody about it. So I didn't know. I didn't know that there are many. Now I know that half the people I associate with have had some sort of abuse or trauma in their life. It may not have been physical abuse. It might've been mental. It might've been emotional. It might've been sexual. When people read my book, I have a 76-year-old aunt that told me when she read my book, I was abused by my father, 76 years old. And I'm just finding out. So that says something about how people hide. And I think that's one of the things I was hoping to help society with my book, is to get people to open up and share and remove the stigma and remove the isolation. Why? Not just so you can more whine, but so you can heal, so that you can feel common community with people who are also healing, who are also hurting, who also had trauma. And so, you know, you feel less alone if you're not the only one. Imagine how you'd feel. I'm the only one in the world that has this. No, you're not. There's many of us. And we can help each other. And that's why I wrote my book, is to help other people heal and remove that some of that isolation and give people hope.
It's a really powerful thing. And I think, you know, one of the things that gets in the way too is not having the words or the language to describe what's happening to you, not knowing it's called something. And so how do you connect with other people who are having that something happen to them when you don't know what that is? And especially also if you feel deserving of it or you brought it on yourself, can you still call it abuse in that formula, you know?
I'm glad you said that, because for many, many, many decades, I thought it was my fault that I joined the church. And it wasn't until I'm a parent and I see how immature a 16, 17-year-old really is, even one with a great upbringing and a great mind and the freedom to think for himself. And then I realized, you know what? That wasn't my fault. I had no choice. I didn't have the capacity to make any other choice. It's the only choice I could have made.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
It took 50 years to realize that. Sad, but there it is.
Right. And so I know we just have a few moments left, and I wanted to ask if there was anything else you wanted to say or any kind of pearls, because you have a lot of them, for people listening.
I would say, if you've been abused and if you have childhood trauma of any sort or church trauma, indoctrination trauma, find a safe person to talk to. If it's not therapy, please get therapy if you can afford it and find a good therapist. And if the therapist doesn't help you, find another one, because not all therapists understand this stuff and not all are the right fit. And I would say if you're still in the middle of it, you can leave. You can leave and start over at any age, no matter how much time you have left. If it's 20, 30, 40 years, 10 years, 5 years, it's better to have 5 years of peace and security and safety than live with an abuser or torment or things that you don't believe in. And for those of us that are lucky enough not to have been abused, be a friend. Listen, hold somebody's hand, put an arm around them and while they cry, and hold your stories back for now. Not me too. Not, we don't need me too right now. What they need is to be listened and to validate them and say, I'm sorry that happened to you. That never should have happened to you. And then ask them, can I help find a support group for you? Can I go with you to Al-Anon? Can I go with you to a church abuse support group? Or can I help you find a therapist? Can I go with you? Like, what can I do to help you? Because this is not right. And sometimes being a friend is all somebody needs. This 1 ounce of love will get them over the hump to start advocating for themselves. And so that's what I would hope.
Yeah. Wow. That's quite beautiful. Really quite amazing. And there's this piece that I want to jump into that you mentioned that's so nuanced, and you can tell, at least I'm assuming you've been there. So it's when you said it's not the time for you to say, oh, that happened to me too. Because if it's taken someone years to have the courage to just begin the conversation, they often don't want to have to pull the conversation back. And once somebody says, oh, yeah, that happened to me, or that happened to my whomever, that's it. Like, you feel like, okay, that's as much as I'm going to get to share, because I don't want to seem aggressive. I don't want to make myself more important than this other person. All of sort of the programming comes in and you just let them take over the conversation. And then that's as much as you get to say. So, right. So just hear someone and listen. And even if they stop, I think to say to them, is there more you wanted to tell me? Just let them just keep going. Because often I think also people in these situations think they're talking too long.
Yes. Because they're so used to not taking for themselves.
Right, right.
They're used to being the givers.
Right.
We're trained to be the givers.
Yeah, yes, absolutely right. Well, it was incredible to speak with you. And I want people to read your book. And where can they find your writings and just find
it? So my book is called Redeemed, A Memoir of a Stolen Childhood. It's available anywhere you buy books. So it's available on Amazon. It's available through your local bookstore. And I have a website. It's www.pennylanewriter.com. And there you'll find all my interviews, stories about my book, feedback from other people about my book, and my email. And so people can email me and ask questions. I'm happy to share anything that I can to help anybody. In Judaism, we have a saying, if you help one person, you help the world. And so like anything I can do to help anybody is the reason I wrote the book. And I'd be glad to do that. So I'm honored to be on your show. Thank you for the work that you do. I didn't have somebody like you right away when I left, and I wish I did. So thank you.
Oh, thank you for saying that. That's very meaningful. Very, very meaningful. It was really lovely to get to know you. And I hope we get to talk again.
I hope so. Thank you so much, Rachel.
One more thing before you go. Oh my, it is very powerful to speak with Penny and to learn about her experiences. I was so moved by so much of what she said. I was, I think, especially moved by hearing about how the church didn't let her heal from her childhood trauma. And that within the context of the trauma she experienced at the hands of adults when she was a child, she was seen as the sinner. And She was sinning by running away, i.e. saving herself, protecting herself, maybe saving her own life. And then she had to ask for forgiveness from her abusive stepmother. Yes, yes. I wrote that down as soon as she said it because I thought, yep, here's another example of a sentence, first of all, that someone says that I will not soon forget. But also, this is something that so many people talk about, and not necessarily even within the cultic context and content and environment. There are plenty of people raised in religious environments. There are plenty of people raised in certain societies where something happens to you that you did not consent to have happen to you. Something happens to you that traumatizes you. Something happens to you at the hands of someone else who has overpowered you, who has abused you, who has neglected you. And it's something you brought on yourself. That's very Scientology. You brought it in. You pulled it in. And it's also something that happens with large group awareness training teachings. You are the victim. You're playing the victim, and you need to somehow stop that. And in these kinds of contexts, it's a very confusing message. I think the intention might be to be empowering, but the confusing part is that you don't get to see that what happened to you was wrong and is not your fault. You don't then get to have a sense of how the world could work in a way that actually would make sense. But the dangerous message for you is that you deserved it. And is that now you have to carry that and you have to pay back for it. Again, doesn't make any sense. I say it haltingly because, you know, when you say things that don't make sense, it's hard to say them smoothly. Like, ooh, you're kind of thinking about it as you're saying it, like A plus B equals doorknob. Like, what? That, But at the same time, it also lets the perpetrator know they can get away with it and they can do that again and they can do worse. And you'll still be the one who has to apologize. You'll still be the sinner. And you'll still be the one who has to ask for their forgiveness. I have never understood that. I've never understood people who are bringing shame on their family when they are raped, when they are attacked. Never, never will I understand that. And maybe because it's not understandable, because it's born out of hatred. It's born out of misogyny, or it's born out of this need to just find the low-hanging fruit. Well, we can't really make a perpetrator change or pay. So instead, let's just have their victim be the person who carries everything. And let's load them up like these sorts of pack mules of responsibility and guilt, because they're already loaded up. So let's just put another pack onto their back, onto their shoulders. I think what's also really important to talk about, to get back to, that she mentioned, is this idea that your value is based on tasks. You know, your value is based on what you do. Your value is based on what you're willing to do, how much you're able to please the people in charge, how much you're able to be self-sacrificial. But value should just be based on you being, period. Your value should be based on just existing, being born into this world. You should have inherent value, full stop. It should not have to be that you need to be the best in order to keep your job. You have to be the best wife in order to be valued enough by your husband, who should love you regardless. It shouldn't be based on what you do and how much you do, because that guideline is always going to be from someone else's perspective. If they want to push you to do more, to sacrifice more, they can then decide that you haven't done enough. You haven't achieved enough tasks. You haven't done them perfectly enough. They're the ones, again, I've sort of used this example of this movable finish line that happens, like when somebody says, what you need to achieve here is enlightenment, but you don't know what that looks like and feels like, or if it's even a thing. But someone can hold the finish line in their hands and just keep placing it out of your reach, a little farther ahead, a little farther ahead. And they'll let you know, because it's this invisible thing, like value, when you've achieved it. And if someone wants you to just keep trying harder, because it doesn't work for them to have you achieve that goal, because then you won't need them anymore and won't be able to use their lack of faith in you and their disappointment in you as your motivator to keep trying harder, well, then you don't ever really get to achieve it. And that's why I really want people to take that back and to say, actually, no, you don't get to decide when I am a good enough person. You don't get to decide when I deserve good things. You don't get to decide when I have value. It's also important to think about what Penny was saying about trying to just make a difference to one person when we talked about why she does this, why she comes forward, why she writes, why she speaks about this. And she said, if I could help at least one person. And it reminded me of a story I heard many times when I was growing up. I went to summer camp, a Jewish summer camp. We heard lots of stories about conscience, about tikkun olam, about repairing the world. And there was the starfish story that we heard, I think, every summer. And then when I became a counselor there, it's a story I told. But it's really about helping one person, but also seeing, tying into the idea of value, seeing one thing as having inherent value, and that's enough. That's enough of a reason to want to tell the story, to help that one person, or to be able to turn things around for one being, one sentient being. And so for those of you who may not have heard it, or even those who have heard it, this is an adaptation of a story, of the original story that was longer in its original form, by Lauren Isley. And it basically goes like this. An old man was walking on the beach one morning after a storm. In the distance, he could see someone moving like a dancer. As he came closer, he saw that it was a young woman picking up starfish and gently throwing them into the ocean. Young lady, why are you throwing starfish into the ocean? So she replied, the sun is up and the tide is going out. And if I do not throw them back in the water, they'll die. So the old man said, but young lady, look around. Do you not realize that there are many miles of beach and thousands of starfish? You cannot possibly make a difference here. The young woman listened politely, then bent down, picked up another starfish, and threw it into the sea. She turned to the man and she said, it made a difference for that one. It's such a good story, and it's so important to remember. Thank you to Penny for all that she does to make a difference. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. all that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.